Howdy, friends, and thanks for joining us here again on Expanded Perspectives. With me, Cam Hale, joining me, of course, as always, it's mi amigo, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I hope everybody's doing really well.
Hope everybody's having a great Labor Day, and
yeah, that's right.
Hope if you know you're not having to work too much. We've got a fun one. We're going to be talking about something that goes on in studio with us often. There's the third man effect. There's always a third man in here. We like to believe there is, but there's not. But we like to blame him for all the mistakes that we make.
Right.
So what have you been going on, Philly?
Oh, not much. Just a lot of work, getting ready for the baseball season to start, the Twins baseball season, not real baseball. Real baseball's ending. But
yeah, right.
Getting ready for that. You know, the kids are starting to get in the swing of things. You know, me too, because I'm the one that has to lug them around everywhere. Because of my job, I'm an independent contractor. I work for myself, so I make my own hours. So I'm stuck with taking the kids to school in the morning. So just trying to get used to that. It's a different
Mr. Mom,
schedule.
That's right. Now, you were telling me something you found in the news.
Yeah, check this out. Well, it reminded me because me and my wife were bored the other night, and we watched a movie called Backwoods, I think it was called. And it's a true story about...
You can stop right there. Wait a minute.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like that, but they go hiking, and then it's just apparently is based on a true story, and a bear actually kills the guy.
Whoa.
And almost kills the girl. Anyways, there's a new article at Mysterious Universe by our friend Paul Seaburn. And it's about bears are rising up against humans around the world. Are you familiar with this, Cam?
No, I'm not.
It's pretty interesting. Now, they say that, you know, of all the animals on the planet Earth, bears are probably right towards the top of the animals that you don't want to piss off.
Yeah, for sure,
they're
right?
They're big, they're strong, they're fast, they got sharp teeth. And one of the scariest things about bears, now this isn't in the article, but I'm going to go ahead and bring it up. You know, like a mountain lion or a lion or a tiger, when it attacks you, it kills you, then eats you.
Mm-hmm.
But bears... they don't worry about killing you. They just start eating.
Just hold you down
so
and
almost
eat.
Every time if you're killed by a bear, you're eaten alive.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Right? That's awesome, right?
And the greatest thing is we're made out of what they like to eat.
That's right. That's right. Anyways, it says that in Russia, there have been dozens of black bears that have overrun a town, and a gang of polar bears are terrorizing an Arctic weather station. It says they think it's that the melting of the polar ice caps has forced bears to new locations. And other places, harsh winters have made food supplies smaller, so the black bears are having to encroach into towns and stuff to find food for sustenance.
And they're Russian bears, so they're even tougher than normal bears.
Right.
Russian bears are way tougher than American bears.
That's right. Now, it says that there's a town called Lechorsk, Russia. That's Lechorsk, Russia. Right?
Sounded perfect. Perfect.
And it says that for over a month... there are 20,000 residents that live in this town, which borders China, have been being attacked by at least 36 Asian black bears. One woman compared it to a full military siege, complete with loudspeakers and trucks blaring warnings. Now, the police there and the firefighters there are having to shoot the bears with, you know, hoses or actual guns. They're just killing them. They've been raiding and they've been attacking people.
So they've been trying to, like, blast them with water or do everything
whatever
they could
can to get
to
rid
try
of.
To deter them, and it's not. So now they're dropping the hammer on
That's
them.
Right. It says that the in central Russian government doesn't seem like it's interested in helping the people. But, I mean, what are they going to do? You know, meanwhile, they said that there's a remote weather station, and there's been a group of researchers that have been trapped there a week by five polar bears. They're just encircling them. They can't leave.
That's not cool at all,
it
man.
It says two meteorologists and one mechanic can't leave their little building. Because of these polar bears that are just waiting for them to leave so they can eat them.
Sounds awesome.
Help, they say, is supposedly on the way.
That's what they're telling them.
But, you know, they don't know. They even say that in the U.S., just during the month of August, that a grizzly bear killed a hiker in Yellowstone Park. Another, a jogger, was in Alaska and was injured by a grizzly bear. And a black bear actually attacked a man in West Virginia. That was just this August.
Oh, man.
So it seems like that, you know... is there a bear uprising, or is climate change forcing these animals to behave differently?
Or just the encroachment of man into where they like to live.
Right, know, or is it just happens to be that this month there was an unusual amount of bear and people episodes.
Something's up, though, when you've got like 30 of them come down together.
I mean, how scary must that be to be like working in this remote weather station, and then there's five monsters basically patrolling, you can't leave.
Would that be a better horror movie than some of the movies they're making today?
Yeah, I think you know so, because I mean? It's real.
If there was like five giant polar bears that just circling and circling.
Have you ever seen a polar bear? I mean, like, I've never seen one in real life, but I have seen like a taxidermied stuffed one at the New York Museum of Science and Natural History. And man, I don't think most people truly appreciate how big they can be when they're standing up.
They're real monsters.
Like 13 feet tall.
They're real monsters.
Yeah, they're real. Yeah, and they're looking to eat these three men.
Yeah,
how terrifying must that be? You're running out of food.
Now, aren't they the only bear that's truly 100% carnivorous? Like, they don't eat anything unless it's made of meat.
That's right, yeah.
I think a polar bear. I mean, the others will eat berries and things along, even grizzly stuff and fish, but not this stuff. You know, they'll eat berries and stuff, but polars, they just won't chew.
And Coca-Cola. They like to drink Coca-Cola.
Oh, that's right. Forgot about that.
See, that's where people all they get all these ideas from, these TV commercials, and, you know, they think, or teddy bears, and they, or, you know, everybody thinks that they're nice. Smokey the Bear.
Yeah.
You know, Yogi the Bear. No.
It doesn't work that way.
They're murderous, carnivorous creatures. They're monsters.
They're monsters.
They
a real
kill
monster.
You. That's right. If just like, you know, who is it? Joe Rogan always says, if a tiger, if a UFO came down and dropped off a tiger or a polar bear and it just started running amok killing people, I mean, everybody on planet Earth would have no problem killing them.
Exactly.
Like, let's get rid of these things. But since they've been here for so long, people, oh, save the tigers. Oh, the polar bears, they're dying out. I say good riddance.
Right? You don't want a monster coming down and getting you?
I don't have any problem with that. No, I don't want that. They don't serve any purpose.
What happens when the next ice age hits and then they have more territory to roam?
Yeah. You're dead.
Then they've got us.
There's a lot of meat laying around.
That's right. A lot of meat. Hey, I got you something cool here, though.
Yeah.
This is going to shift gears a little bit, though. And this just went down in Charlotte, Vermont. Two people on a Saturday claims that they saw a dinosaur-like creature swimming in the waters of, prepare yourself, my friends, Lake Champlain.
Oh, yeah. No,
Champy.
I was going to say, yeah, there's a monster there.
This comes from, of course, our friends at Cryptozoology News. This is a 71-year-old writer, Lisa Arthur. She told Cryptozoology News that she was with her friend, Ina Danko, a 72-year-old school superintendent, when the animal showed up on September 1st. And they say this, we were riding in a jet boat across from Charlotte. The water was glassy, and there weren't other boats around. We saw what first appeared to be a swimmer some 50 feet away. Ina saw it first and was alarmed, thinking it was a swimmer too far out from shore for safety. That says the surprise came when the two women realized that what they were looking at wasn't the head of a human. It says its head was attached to a long body. It began making swirling waves that broke with a white froth. Now, they go on to say that they observed this unidentified being for about 3 minutes as the creature went underwater. Now, Arthur recalls the swirling continued for a few minutes until, again, the water kind of glassed off where you could tell there wasn't anything going. So she says, again, that the water was a little too stirred up for them to tell anything. They weren't able to see, you know, into the water. They got up there on it. None of it. They weren't able to see any of that. But she estimates that this creature was about 30 feet long.
Whoa.
Now, what could that be? If they both saw this.
I don't know.
I don't know these women, but I'm going to call into question the eyesight of a 71 and 72-year-old woman. I don't know how far out. You know what I'm saying?
No, I'm
going to call
into
the eyesight. But even then, I mean, what could you mistaken for something that size?
I don't know. I mean, I guess.
They like to say logs. They say all
sturgeon,
kinds of stuff.
I've heard.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it could be something like that. Or, like you're saying, their perception is just off, and it's really not as big as they think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's probably what it is, right?
I'm going to read you a story here that's pretty interesting, and this is from Miss Alter. Now, she actually explained that this wasn't the first time that she'd seen it. The first time she spotted this thing was in 1980. She was there with her family, and she says, we were there at Otter Creek where it flows into Lake Champlain. There were 14 of us, my parents, ex-husband, brothers, sisters, and their spouses. We heard waves crashing on the rocks along the shore and ran out of the cottage. Maybe 15 feet off the shore, we saw a long, dark, snake-like creature winding through the water so that three or four humps broke the surface in a rolling movement. The skin appeared to be scaly, and the light reflected jaggedly off the scales. She says that the wake was quite large and broke like small ocean waves. It wound along the shore and then headed out to deeper water. She says that I feel the creature Ina and I saw was similar to the one I saw with my family in the 80s.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot of these stories of these different lake monsters, just in that lake, but other lakes across North America.
Well, she goes on to say that she thinks that it really resembles what she looked into was a plesiosaur. That's what she goes on. So it always makes me question. I mean, this goes back into all the crypto stuff we cover. It always makes me question, are we really seeing it? Are these things really there? Or is these little time slips that something just pops in, pops out? Or is it in another dimension? Where are these things coming from? Because much like the whole Bigfoot argument, if this thing is legit and is a real plesiosaur,
yeah,
where's the breeding population? What do they eat? What is it? You know what I mean? What is this?
I understand. And I don't know why, but for me, I don't believe any of these stories when it has to do with like a lake monster. I don't know why. I'm not saying they don't exist. But
that's your jumping off point.
For whatever reason, I was like, nah, that can't be real. But you know, a chupacabra, that's totally real. Or a Bigfoot, yeah, that's real. Flying humanoid, that's real. Lake monster, Loch Ness monster, nah, man, I don't think that's real. I mean, I don't know why. Right? That's retarded to say that. But I just feel...
At least you're open in saying that, that you're just like, well, I don't know. I don't feel like it's real.
You say all the time, like, you don't believe in a lot of the extraterrestrial signs mm-hmm. that people have. You think that it's a sleep problem. Mm-hmm. They're hallucinating these visitors in their room, you know, where I'm not so sure. I think everybody has one thing where they're just like, nah, I don't know.
It doesn't mean I don't like the stories, the same as Kyle, but it's just one of those things. It's hard for me, and I'm not telling anybody else to believe that way. I'm just being honest. It's hard for me to believe. I don't know why I'm open to everything, but there's one thing that I'm like, man, I don't know. And that's your one thing.
Yeah, I don't know why. I don't have a good reason.
I don't either.
It doesn't make sense. Look, there's a lot of things I do that don't make sense. Why am I so open-minded about Sasquatch, but not a lake monster? You know, I don't know why that is, but I just, for some reason, I'm always like,
I know why I'm not as open-minded about some of these alien visitations. I know why. It's because in the deep crevices of my body, it scares the hell out of me. And I would just as soon pretend...
That it doesn't exist.
That it doesn't exist. That I would just... If I don't see it, it don't see me. You know what I mean? It's just... This sheet is bulletproof. And if I pull this sheet up over my head under the covers, nothing can get me.
Well, you know, speaking of that, we were talking about the bear in the movie I was watching. Well, you know, just like always... In the movie, they're hiding inside their tent, and the bear, I mean, it's like literally pressing its muzzle against the little neoprene.
A thin sheet of nylon. Like,
shh, we'll be a care, zip it up. I'm like, why is it that people think that that little piece of cloth is going to stop it from coming in?
That'd be like a Twinkie thinking it's safe because it's wrapped in cellophane. You're like, bitch, I'm coming.
Well, let's take a break, folks, and when we get back from the break, we're going to get into something really interesting I think everybody's going to like. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Then I went below, and threw myself upon the cabin floor in great pain. How long I lay there, I could not tell, for I became delirious. When I came to, as I thought, from my swoon, I realized that the sloop was plunging into a heavy sea. And looking out of the companionway, to my amazement, I saw a tall man at the helm. His rigid hand grasping the spokes of the wheel held him as in a vice. One may imagine my astonishment. His rig was that of a foreign sailor, and a large red cap he wore was cock-billed over his left ear, and all was set off with a shaggy black whiskers. He would have been taken for a pirate in any part of the world. While I gazed upon his threatening aspect, I forgot the storm, and wondered if he had come to cut my throat. This he seemed to divine. Senor, he said, doffing his cap, I have come to do you no harm. And a smile, the faintest in the world, but still a smile, played upon his face, which seemed not unkind when he spoke. I have come to do you no harm. I have sailed free, he said, but was never worse than a contrabandista. I am one of Columbus's crew, he continued. I am the pilot of the Pinta. Come to aid you. Lie quiet, Señor Capitan, he added, and I will guide your ship tonight. You have a calentura, but you will be all right tomorrow. I thought what a very devil he was to carry sail. Again, as if he read my mind, he exclaimed, yonder is the Pinta ahead. We must overtake her. Give her sail. Give her sail. Vail, vail, muy vail. Biting off a large quid of black twist, he said, you did wrong, Capitan. You mix cheese with plums. White cheese is never safe unless you know where it comes from. Now, that little clip there comes from a book titled Sailing Alone Around the World, and it was written by a very unique fellow named Joshua Slocum. And in April, on April 24th of 1895, he actually became the very first man to sail single-handedly around the world. And he disappeared in November of 1909 while aboard his boat called the Spray. Now, that little outtake comes from that book. The reason we chose that is because it's going to get into what we're discussing today. We're discussing the third man effect. And there's more in the book, which is, it's a very interesting book. It's a great book. It's one of those ones, a book over 100 years old, still being published. And it's, of course, travelers and sailors. Everybody loves to read it. But that little part right there, there's more to it. There's quite a bit more to his tale. But he actually had dealings with this man when he was very sick. He was in the middle of the ocean. This guy just appears on his ship, helps him get through the storms while he's food poisoned, basically. Shakes it off. He gets to feeling better. And the guy vanishes. So, and this isn't the first time people have, or this is actually like maybe the first in writing that we can find where they started talking about it, but
there was another more. Yeah, there was another really popular case back on May 20th, 1916, when the legendary explorer Ernest Shackleton, Frank Worsley, and Tom Crean reached Stromness, which is a whaling station on the north coast of South Georgia. Now, when we're talking about Georgia, we're talking about Antarctica. Now, they had been walking for 36 hours in life-threatening conditions in an attempt to reach help for the rest of their stranded party. Now, three of their crew were stuck, like I said, on the south side of the island, and the remainder were stranded on Elephant Island. So in order to reach the whaling station, the three men had to cross the island's mountainous interior with just a rope and just one axe, in a journey that few had attempted before or since. And by reaching Stromness, they had managed to save all the men and their crew from their ill-fated, you know, death if they hadn't have done it. Now, they did not talk about it at the time, but weeks later, all three men independently reported about an uncanny experience during their trek. They said that they had a feeling that there were not the three of them, but that there were four. They think that there were four men on their journey, and this fourth person accompanied them. He was a silent person. I mean, like it was a silent presence. They didn't physically see him.
Mm-hmm.
They had just felt them, him or her, walking by their side and giving them hope, giving them, you know, the urge to press on. Now, later, the poet T.S. Eliot wrote a poem about it, and he heard of Shackleton's story, and he decided to call it The Third. And he actually says in one of his poems, the poem The Wasteland, he says, "Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together. But when I look up ahead the white road, there's always another walking beside you." Now, ever since his famous poem, this situation or this experience is called the third man factor or the third man effect.
Mm-hmm.
But that's some of the earliest traces. And it appears that there's a lot of other cases of people in dire circumstances, circumstances where they're really alone. And this pops up all the time. Now there's a book and I find fascinating. And it's called The Third Man Factor by John Geiger. And he collects a lot of these stories, a wide range of these third man stories, including accounts from mountaineers, sailors, astronauts even, and survivors of even terrorist attacks, and they all involve this strong impression of a felt presence,
mm-hmm.
sometimes a voice or a shadow-like image, but oftentimes without a clear form. So we've got some stories here. Let's get into those. Ron DeFrancesco was at his desk at Eurobrokers, a financial trading firm on the 84th floor of the Southern Tower of the World Trade Center in New York when the plane struck the North Tower opposite him. It was 8:46 a.m. on September 11th, 2001. There was a loud boom, and the lights in the South Tower flickered. Gray smoke poured from the North Tower. At impact, all the stairwells in the North Tower became impassable. From the 92nd floor up, trapping 1,356 people. Some waved desperately for help. Most of those who worked at Eurobrokers started to evacuate the building. But DeFrancesco stayed. A few minutes later, announcement was broadcast over the building's public address system. An incident had occurred in the other building. But Building 2 is secure. There is no need to evacuate Building 2. If you are in the midst of an evacuation, you may return to your office by using the reentry doors on the reentry floors and the elevators to return to your office. Repeat, Building 2 is secure. DeFrancesco, a money market broker, originally from Hamilton, Ontario,
decided to telephone his wife to tell her that the airplane had hit the other tower, but that he was fine and he intended to stay at work. "It was Tower 1 that was hit. I'm in Tower 2, he told her. He tried to focus his attention on the screens of the financial data on his desk. Then a friend from Toronto called him. "Get the hell out of there," he said. They spoke briefly. Then DeFrancesco agreed. He called a few major clients and his wife again to tell them that his change of plans. Then he began walking toward the bank of elevators. At 9:03 a.m., 17 minutes after the first impact, the second plane hit. United Airlines Flight 175, traveling at 590 miles an hour, sliced into the South Tower, igniting an intense fire, fed by up to 11,000 gallons of jet fuel. The Boeing 767, carrying 56 passengers, two pilots, and seven flight attendants. It had been commandeered by Al-Qaeda terrorists after taking off from Boston's Logan International Airport en route to Los Angeles. It struck the building's south face between floors 77 and 85. The plane banked just before it slammed into the building. The higher wing cut into the Eurobroker's offices, while the fuselage hit the Fuji Bank offices on the 79th through 82nd floors. DeFrancesco was hurled against the wall and showered with ceiling panels and other debris. Brackets, air ducts, and cables sprang from the ceiling. The building itself swayed. The trading floor he had just left no longer existed. DeFrancesco entered Stairway A. The South Tower had three emergency stairwells. Fortuitously, he had stumbled on the only one that offered hope of escape for people above the zone of impact. The stairwell was shielded from destruction by an enormous elevator machine room on the 81st floor, where the nose of the 767 hit. The elevator equipment covered more than half of the floor space and had forced the tower's architects to route Stairway A from the center of the building toward the northwest corner of the building, the farthest point from the impact zone. DeFrancesco was joined by others in the stairwell, and all began to descend. The stairwell was smoky, lit only by a flashlight carried by Brian Clark, an executive vice president at Eurobrokers and a volunteer fire marshal on the 84th floor. Three flights down, they encountered a heavy woman and a male colleague who were coming up. "You've got to go up. Go up. You can't go down," the woman insisted. "There's too much smoke and flames below." They debated whether to ascend and either wait for firefighters or a rooftop rescue by helicopter, or persist with their descent, risking the smoke and flames. Clark shone his flashlight into his colleagues' faces, asking each one, "You want to go up or you want to go down?" They heard someone call for help, and Brian Clark grabbed DeFrancesco by the sleeve. "Come on, Ron, let's get this fellow." The two men left the stairwell and fought through the debris on the 81st floor to locate the person. But DeFrancesco was soon overcome by smoke. He had a backpack, and he held it over his face in an attempt to filter the air, but it wasn't helping. He was forced to retreat. Gasping for air, he decided to ascend, hoping to escape the smoke. He climbed several flights, but at each landing, when he tested the fire doors, he discovered that they were locked. A mechanism designed to prevent smoke from flooding the building had malfunctioned after the impact, preventing any of the doors, even on designated re-entry floors, from being opened. He continued to climb and eventually caught up with some other colleagues from Eurobrokers, several of whom were already helping a large woman. The woman had convinced all of them that their best route was to go up the South Tower. But as DeFrancesco continued up, the stairwell became more crowded. All the fire doors were locked. He guessed he had reached the 91st floor of the 110-story building. Ron DeFrancesco is normally unflappable. He is a money market broker in a high-stakes business that demands steel nerves. But he is slightly claustrophobic. And with the intensifying smoke, he started to begin to panic. He thought of his family, and he had to see his wife and children again at all costs. He determined that he was going to make it out. De Francisco decided to turn around and start to go back down. This time, the situation was much worse. Thick smoke poured up through the narrow stairwell. He groped his way down, unable to see more than a few feet ahead. He stopped at a landing, in the middle of the impact zone, on the 79th or 80th floor. Overcome by the smoke, he joined others, about a dozen people in all. Some stretched out, face down on the concrete floor. Others crouched in the corners, all gasping for air. They were blocked from the descending any further. By a collapsed wall, he could see panic in all of their eyes. Mostly fear. Some were even crying. Several began to slip into unconsciousness. Then something remarkable happened. Someone told me to get up. Someone, he said, called me. The voice, which was male, but did not belong to one of the people in the stairwell, was insistent. Get up! It addressed DeFrancisco by his first name and gave him encouragement. It was, hey, you can do this. But it was more than a voice. There was also a vivid sense of physical presence. A lot of people made split-second decisions that day that determined whether or not they lived or died. What is different about Ron DeFrancisco is, at that critical moment, he received help from a seemingly external source. He had the sensation that somebody lifted me up. He felt that he was being guided. I was led to the stairs. I don't think somebody was grabbing my hands, but I was definitely led. He resumed his descent and soon saw a point of light. He followed it, fighting his way through drywall and other debris as it all collapsed. Some of it was obstructing the stairwell. He continued through the flames. He recoiled from the fire, but still someone helped him. An angel, somebody, urged him along. There was still danger. So it led me to the stairwell. It led me to break through. It led me to run through the fire. There was obviously somebody encouraging me. That's not where you go. You don't go toward the fire. He covered his head with his forearms and continued down, now running. He was singed by the fire. He believed that flames continued for three stories. Finally, he reached a clear, lit stairwell below the fire on the 76th floor. Only then did the sense of a benevolent helper, one who had been with him for 5 minutes. Now, DeFrancisco said at this point, I think at that point it let me go. When he was making his way down, he passed three firefighters climbing up the stairs. I'm having trouble breathing, he said. He was told that he would find some help at the bottom. DeFrancisco continued down as fast as he could, finally reaching the plaza level. He headed for an exit, but was stopped by a security guard, who told him that it was too dangerous. He looked out in horror at the falling debris and all the victims. He was directed to another exit. He walked back through the concourse, toward the northeast exit near Church Street. He was still in extreme danger. 56 minutes had passed since the first plane hit. The impact had severed many of South Tower's vertical support columns. The heat from the explosion and fire had weakened the steel trusses. The floors of the crippled buildings began to pancake down in a floor-by-floor collapse. As he approached the Church Street exit, DeFrancisco heard an ungodly roar. He saw a fireball as the building compressed. He doesn't know what happened next and was unconscious for some time after his narrow escape. Waking up much later at St. Vincent Hospital in Manhattan. Ron DeFrancisco was the last person at a south tower of the World Trade Center before it came down at 9:59 a.m. The south tower collapsed in 10 seconds, causing a ferocious windstorm and a massive debris cloud. According to the official 9/11 Commission report, DeFrancisco was one of only four people to escape the building from above the 81st floor. The early morning was perfectly still and silent. James Figney, a 28-year-old university student originally from Hanover, New Hampshire, and his friend Richard Whitmire set out to climb Delta Form, a mountain in the Canadian Rockies near Lake Louise, Alberta. They ascended an ice gully in the late winter light on April 1st, 1983, roped together and using ice screws to use on their climb. Whitmire, a 23-year-old from Bellingham, Washington, was in the lead. At one point, cut loose some ice. He yelled a warning, "Falling ice!" to Svegny below. The ice catapulted safely past Svegny, but was suddenly followed by the collapse of a snowfield above the Kalur on the north face. A tremendous roar broke the silence, and the bright light was consumed by instant darkness. An avalanche swept the two men nearly 2,000 feet to the base of Delta Form. Svegny was unconscious almost from the moment that the avalanche started. Whitmire might have escaped had the pair not been roped together. When Svegny regained consciousness, he guessed about an hour later, he was severely injured. His back was broken in two places. One arm was fractured. The other had severed nerves from a broken scapula and was hanging limply at his side. He had cracked ribs, torn ligaments in both knees, and suffered internal bleeding. His face, a broken nose, broken teeth, and open wounds. He was a mess. He had no idea where he was and what had happened to him. At first he thought he might be in Nepal, where he had spent 6 months trekking a few years earlier. Now Svegny had finished his master's degree, and at that time of the accident was basically a climbing bum. Living out of his Volkswagen, he went from mountain to mountain, ridge to ridge, to practice his climbing. It took a while for him to recognize the mountain, but gradually Svegny remembered the climb, and he struggled to his feet to look for his friend. Whitmire lay nearby, and from his misshapen body it was clear that he was dead. Svegny lay down beside him, certain he would soon follow. "I figured that if I would just fall asleep, it would probably be the easiest way to go." He lay there for about 20 minutes. Shivers were gradually replaced by the sensation of warmth brought about by shock and hypothermia, and he began to doze off. He realized that there was no vast gulf separating life and death, but rather a fine line, and at that moment, Svegny thought it would be easier to cross that line than it would be to struggle on. He then felt a strange sensation, an invisible being very close at hand. It was something I couldn't see, but it was a physical presence. The presence communicated mentally, and the message was clear. "You can't give up. You have to try." It told me what to do. The only decision I had made at that point in time was to lie down next to Rick and fall asleep and accept my death. That's the only decision I made. All decisions made subsequent to that were made by the presence. I was merely taking instructions. I understood what it wanted me to do. It wanted me to live. The presence urged Svegny to get up. It dispensed practical advice. It told him, for example, to follow the blood dripping from the tip of his nose as if it were an arrow pointing the way. As he walked, he kept breaking through the crust of the deep snow and was almost unable to pull his feet back up because of his injuries. Part of the time, he even crawled. The presence, which stood behind his right shoulder, implored him to continue, even when the struggle to survive seemed unattainable. And when he fell silent, Svegny still knew his companion was close at hand. Because of its enormous empathy, he thought of the presence as a woman. She accompanied Svegny across the Valley of the Ten Peaks to the camp where he and Whitmire had started from earlier that day, a point where he hoped he could find food and warmth and perhaps even some help. Such were his injuries that it took nearly all day to make the crossing, which was really only about a mile, and his companion was with him every step of the way. When he reached the camp, Svegny could not crawl into his sleeping bag because his injuries were too severe, and he could not eat because his teeth were broken off and his face was too badly swollen. He could not even light his stove. He sat down, and from the position of the sun, he began to realize that it was late afternoon. He believed that in a couple of hours he would be dead after all this. I recall knowing I was about to die, pathetically, in a fetal position in the snow. He had always felt that he might die while climbing, so it came to no real surprise, he thought, about how devastated his mother might be, how his other siblings might feel. Then at once, he thought he heard some other voices, and he called out for help. There was no response. It was at that moment that he felt the presence leave. It was gone. There was nothing there. There was no presence. Why had it left me? There was no one telling me what to do. I couldn't hear it anymore. It had just left. For the first time since the avalanche, he was overwhelmed by a sense of loneliness. What I thought then was, I'm hallucinating. The presence knows I'm dead, and it has just given up on me. But as it turns out, those were people, and they did come up. One of them skied out and flew me out that night in a helicopter. In fact, the present had left because it knew that I was safe. Now, Alan Derbyshire, who was in the party with two other cross-country skiers, said he heard a faint cry.
Help! I've been in an avalanche!
Had Derbyshire not heard him, Svegny would have been left for the night and would almost certainly have died. There were no other skiers or climbers in the area. Derbyshire found him staggering around in bad shape and got the impression that his condition was critical. When Derbyshire finally found him, he called the forest patrol and they got him out of there. He said Svegny at that time made no mention of an unseen companion. And in a newspaper interview weeks later, the Banff National Park rescue officer Tim Auger later said that Svegny was lucky both to survive the fall and then also to be discovered by the cross-country skiers who happened to be in that area. Svegny himself understood that there was way more than luck involved. The opening to the underwater cave was barely wider than her shoulders. When she slipped through, Stephanie Schwab entered a world few have ever seen, a world of absolute darkness, now brilliantly illuminated by her light. The crystalline walls of the cave glittered like jewels. Bone-white stalactites and stalagmites reached out toward her as she swam deeper and further into the mermaid's lair on the south side of Grand Bahama Island. For all its strangeness, it was a routine dive for 40-year-old underwater explorer, rated by then Diver International magazine as one of the top divers in the world, except for the fact that she was alone. Usually Schwab dived with her husband, a British cave explorer named Rob Palmer. He was an expert on the Blue Holes of the Bahamas, a system of spectacular submarine caves that includes the world's deepest known blue hole, a vertical cave given its name because of the water of the cave is much, much darker than the blue of the shallow water around it. It is a world of skeletal calcite appendages and a vast hidden cathedral inhabited by only small, colorless species of sea life, many unknown to science to this day. Even today, most of the caves remain unexplored. The Mermaid's Lair, an extensive horizontal cave, was an exception. It had been explored previously by Palmer and Schwab together, but not this day. Palmer was already dead. He had failed to surface after a dive in the Red Sea earlier that year. Schwab was left to continue alone their challenging and dangerous work, researching the water-filled Bahamian cave systems. It was late August 1997, and Schwab, a geomicrobiologist, was there to collect sediment samples for another scientist who was studying dust from the Sahara Desert that, centuries earlier, had been carried by the winds across the Atlantic Ocean and deposited on the floor of the mermaid's lair. The day had already been unexpectedly eventful. When she was diving out to the dive site, Schwab had been forced to the stop by a poisonwood tree that had been blown down by a storm the day before and was blocking the road. It took all of her strength to push it aside, and in the process, she suffered serious skin irritations from the alkaloids in the sap. She decided to continue, however, and having reached her destination, climbed into her scuba gear and began her dive, focused on collecting the samples and exiting quickly. Once she reached the floor of the cave, she spent half an hour diligently gathering the red dust samples, and when she was finished, Schwab packed her equipment away, and for the first time since she had reached that spot, she lifted her eyes. She suddenly realized that she could no longer see her guideline. She searched for it, at first calmly, but then with increasing anxiety, but could not find it. Now, cave diving is technically challenging. Unlike other forms of diving, in an emergency, a diver cannot ascend directly to the surface, but must swim horizontally, sometimes through a maze of narrow passages. The guideline is vital to getting out safely, especially out of such a complex submarine cave system. It is literally a lifeline. Without it, a diver can quickly become disoriented, eventually run out of air, and be asphyxiated. Now, Schwab experienced a growing sense of panic. She immediately realized her mistake. When she dived with Palmer, her ex-husband, she often relied on him to serve as her guide. On this dive, she had inadvertently fallen into the same old pattern and lost sight of the line. I had based my dive on the unplanned assumption that he was there, but he was not there and had not been for months. She was alone. She checked her tank gauge and realized that she had only 20 minutes of air left. Schwab's panic turned into anger. She flew into a rage, furious at Palmer for his death, her sense of loss as palpable as the terror she felt, angry too at herself for being so stupid, making an elementary diving mistake that threatened now to claim her own life. For all intents and purposes, at that moment, I had given up on life. I was ready to leave this world. I was so depressed, and I missed Rob so much, I had had enough of the pain. Then, at the height of her rage and sadness, Schwab said, I suddenly felt flushed, and it seemed like my field of vision had become brighter. She vividly felt the presence of another being with her. There was no doubt in her mind that someone was with her in the cave. She believed it to be her dead husband. She heard his voice, communicating mentally with her. All right, Steffi, calm down. Remember, believe you can, believe you can't. Either way, you're right. Remember. It is something her husband Palmer used to say to her all the time, acting as an invocation to her inner strength. Schwab was stunned by the intervention, but it was a help to her, and she did calm down. She sat there on the floor of the cave, trying to handle what her brain was doing, and after about 15 minutes had passed, she had realized she had lost the line and time was running out. When she looked up again, she did so with a renewed resolve and calm. She methodically scanned the cave. She thought she saw a flash of white light, or white line. Simultaneously, she felt as if the presence had gone now. Schwab was alone again in the cave. She looked up once more, and that's where she caught a glimpse of her guideline, and she saw it again. Schwab immediately swam up to the line and followed it out. Eventually, she saw the blue entrance where the light had filtered into the cave, and she thought to herself, today was not a good day to die. She felt as if she had been saved by the presence she was sure of was her deceased husband.
In March 1916, Henry Hugh Gordon, Stoker, and two fellow prisoners of war escaped Turkish captivity and made a dash for freedom. Born in Dublin and a cousin of Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, Stoker had joined the Royal Navy at the age of 15. At 29, he was chosen to command AE-2, a submarine built for the Royal Australian Navy. When the First World War broke out 8 months later, Stoker set sail from Sydney to the Mediterranean. He was ordered to force a passage up the Dardanelles into the Sea of Marmora, and then to generally run amok. He succeeded in harassing some Turkish warships before the submarine had to be scuttled, and Stoker and his crew were eventually captured. Over time, Stoker was moved to the fortress of Afyonkara Hisar, where he was held a prisoner of war. It was, he later wrote, a living death. Unwilling to endure it, on March 23, 1916, Stoker and two others made a daring escape while Turkish sentries were distracted by an accomplice. When they were finally missed, the camp commandant did not trouble to send guards in pursuit because he knew the prospects for the trio were so bleak. In order to reach the coast, they would have to cross 300 miles of rugged, Taurus Mountains, without compasses, without maps, or even adequate clothing. Stoker and his men traveled in under the cloak of darkness, having to cover 15 miles a night if their food ration of raisins and powdered cocoa was to hold out. Stoker himself wrote, "As we were often above or near the snow line, the cold was intense and sleep impossible when further progress was barred. Ever present was that ghastly hunted feeling, and hunger, thirst, foot soreness, and physical strain. They hid and rested during the daylight hours. On the 11th night, hungry and dispirited, they undertook a grueling march through a mountain pass, buffeted by heavy winds, their exhaustion compounded by nerves. At one point, they thought they saw lights flashing and feared that they had been sighted by their pursuers who had signaled to the soldiers ahead." Stoker wrote, "In the midst of the night, I felt, not suddenly or surprisedly, that we were not three men struggling along in a line, but four. There was a fourth man, following at the end of our line, in the correct position for a fourth man to be. When we stopped for a few moments, rests, he did not join us, but remained in the darkness, out of sight. Yet as soon as we rose and resumed our march, he dropped into his place forthwith. He never spoke, nor did he go ahead to lead us. His attitude seemed just that of a true and loyal friend who says, 'I cannot help, but when danger is at hand, remember always that I am here to stand or fall with you.'" They trekked through the night and breached the pass before dawn. With the immediate danger past, Stoker turned back and saw that the figure was no longer accompanying them. He made no mention of the extra man to the other two. It was only after they reached a safe place to stop for the day and had made a fire and had sipped on some hot cocoa that the subject even came up. One of Stoker's colleagues began by asking, "Did either of you see anything?" When no one answered, he continued, I thought I saw another man." Then the other one said, "I saw him too." Stoker later described the exchange. "They had both seen him. We had all three been able to sense his presence throughout the most trying part of the night. We all three agreed that the moment he left us was when we felt we had put the danger behind. Again, I cannot exaggerate how real his presence was, how content one felt, despite the mystery of it, that he should be there. What a strength and comfort his presence seemed to be. It was a strange experience. We felt that his presence had brought us great luck." Stoker elaborated slightly in a 1930s interview, saying that he and his companions were agreed on the presence's general movements, the sense of friendliness, and the comfort that he had given them. With the presence gone, their luck shortly ended. "Our boots were in ribbons, food finished, strength ebbing fast. Food must be obtained at whatever the cost, or else we'll only drop in our tracks and die. They came across a goat herd and threw themselves at their mercy. They provided the men with food, but then after they left, they reported them to the Turkish authorities. They reached the Mediterranean, as Stoker described it, a wondrous, soul-inspiring, body-inspiriting sight to three worn and weary sailors. But on the 18th day of their flight, they heard a crash in the bushes around their hiding place and found themselves staring down the barrels of rifles held by highly agitated Turkish soldiers. They were once again prisoners of war. Stoker would not be freed until February of 1917. After the war had ended, Stoker wrote to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the Sherlock Holmes series, about his encounter with a fourth presence. Doyle, who had an acute interest in the supernatural, replied, "It is the same experience as Shackleton's sledge party, which had an extra man. One of you was probably mediumistic without knowing it. Many are. Some friend took advantage of that fact. A world populated by unseen beings that can be summoned as required during times of great need bears little resemblance to the rational world we are supposed to inhabit. It seems like a throwback to an earlier age, when monks would disappear into the desert for years, only to emerge with accounts of religious epiphanies and encounters with divine beings. Or when it was generally accepted that guardian angels watched over each and every one of us and would come as needed to our spiritual and physical aid. The first and most obvious explanation for a third man factor, then, is that it is merely a contemporary twist on a very old idea, that of the guardian angel. The conditions encountered by explorers are, after all, not very different from the isolation and hardship that invited interventions from guardian angels or God in the past." Back with Expanded Perspectives. Hope everybody enjoyed those stories. Like I said, the book is called The Third Man Factor by John Geiger. That's G-E-I-G-E-R. I'll put notes in the on the website and in the show notes. It's an interesting book. There's a ton of more stories in there, and I just find it really interesting. I mean, it seems like there's several things that bring this on, whether it's sleep deprivation. They said that a lot of cases that cold brings it on, extreme cold, living in a really cold environment, physical threats to life, like being severely injured, like it was talked about in those stories. They all seem to trigger this feeling of a presence, and it's almost as if this is a spiritual guide or you know, like a guardian angel. Some people perceive it as a guardian angel, especially religious people. Others just perceive it as a dead loved one or a parent, a sibling, a good friend that has passed on that for some reason comes back and helps them. Some people say that they don't know who it is at all, but they just still feel like whatever it is, it intervenes. And I mean, it's like clearly talking to them. What I find interesting is they say that even people in extreme isolation, like in the book, they're giving a story of a woman who's a scientist, and she's working at a scientific research laboratory there on Antarctica. And it's really cold out this time of year. It's like the dead of winter. It's like 50 below. She's by herself in this small little room, probably like the size of the studio, by herself for hours a day. And it's like that constant being alone. She starts saying that she could sometimes feels like she's not alone, like there's something there. And she would look around all the time and would never see anything, didn't feel scared, didn't feel alarmed, but she just constantly felt like there was something, you know, off her shoulder. She said she would catch herself looking over and but never see anything. And this had gone on for a while, and she'd even talked to some of the other scientists there, and they're like, "Oh yeah, you're talking about the when you're in cabin 5 or whatever?" They're like, "Yeah, every time I'm out there for some whatever reason, I feel like there's something there." Now, what is that? Is it a ghost? I mean, it could be a lot of things. The same thing is experienced, they say, by there's a story of a Russian-like cosmonaut up in space, all alone, in this Soviet space station.
and he feels all alone, and he always feels like there's a presence there. He says his deceased father, he feels it's his father's presence when he's up there.
It always makes me wonder, I mean, like that, is this really something that's going on, or is this the way that maybe our brain, some chemical, something that our brain does in order to keep us focused and from actually losing our minds if we are in solitary situations?
Well, they talk about that, and it's been discussed for a long time by psychiatrists and stuff. You're right. Is there really a presence that's appearing and manifesting itself to these people, or is it just your mind? Because you've been in a sleep deprivation tank, okay, or an isolation tank.
Isolation tape, yeah.
And when you're there, your mind is just racing and grasping at anything. So imagine you're by yourself, completely isolated. Is your mind inventing this to keep you from being so bored? Somebody in a really monotonous task? Is that what it is? But then there's other stories where it's obvious, like the one we read about the guy who broke his back and everything. I mean, that was a voice that was guiding him out. He wasn't bored.
Or the wife.
He was about to give up on life. Yeah. And something kicked in and said, no, get your ass in gear.
Yeah.
Get to moving. You're going to make it out of here. And sure enough, the presence of it is gone. It's left me. Started to feel sad. And then that's when the humans show up.
Yeah.
It's like it carried him just enough.
Got him just far enough.
The woman that said she felt her husband helped her just enough to get to that guideline.
Yeah.
So there's different circumstances, but I'm with you. They also talk about trauma can bring this on, like cases where children, they say in cases or households where children are brought up and they're often abused or even just neglected, it brings on this imaginary friend. Lots of children have an imaginary friend. They say, is that because of stress, or is there a real presence that's intervening trying to help the kid? Like imagine a kid that's in a home where the parents are both alcoholics or drug abusers. Then nobody feeds the kid. The kid is totally on his own. Is this presence showing up to help the child make it through? Like, look, buddy, you're going to be okay. Don't worry about those dirt bags.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to help you. This is the decision you need to make. And help us guide them into a way out of that. I mean, I don't know.
I don't know, yeah.
It's very interesting. And then you were even mentioning that there's definite signs where it's like a guardian angel that's like looking out for you.
Exactly. There's a lot of stories of that you can pull up, stacks and stacks, and I believe John even has written another book about guardian angels, is what people and of course people of the Christian faith can really relate to the whole guardian angel idea. They really like, but it does seem that way. I've got a few little quick stories here I'm going to tell you that we're talking about guardian angels. Tommy actually wrote this when he was 20 years old. I was driving down a road about 50 miles an hour approaching an intersection where the opposing traffic had the stop sign. They had to stop. He said, I didn't have to stop. But he said, I heard loud as can be, and he said, I was the only one in the car, in a very distinctive male voice, he heard, slow the car. So he said, I slowed down to about 20, and about that time, a motorcyclist ran through the stop sign. He said, had I continued at 50, I would have hit him.
Right?
He goes, so I'm not sure if it was my guardian angel or his guardian angel, but something said in a voice, I heard, slow down the car. And that's not the only one. I mean, there's a girl actually writes that she was driving by an intersection, a busy intersection, by a church. And she heard out of nowhere in her mind, put up the windows and lock the doors. Said, so for no reason, she did it. Boom, boom, boom. Said the light was red. So she does it all like that, looks up and said, the minute she looks over, there's a young man at the door tugging on the handle and trying to get into her car.
Yeah. What is that?
It's a man. I don't have any idea. There's so many ones. There was another one here where a guy said that his, him and his wife and his son were coming back, going in between visiting family and had the fuel pump go out on their vehicle. So he sent his wife on down the road, I guess walking with the son or whatever, when he was working on it, or got in with somebody, didn't really not clearly said, but anyway, to go get another fuel pump. And he was working on his truck. And he said he's standing and he's with his back towards traffic and he's leaned up against the truck. And he said in his mind, he hears a voice in his ears says, you're going to get hit. You have to move. And he said he don't know why he got this feeling. Walked around to the other side of the truck, to the Barditch side of the truck. In 30 seconds, a car topped off that on-ramp and sideswiped right where he was standing. Now, what is that? Is that your ESP? Is it you reaching out to this like these people? Or is that something physically coming to you? I mean, because this is almost like it's coming directly to you. And it's not like it lingers. It's not like, oh, I've seen it before. I've heard it before. No, it's almost a one-time deal. This is going to happen.
Yeah.
And then you don't have it anymore.
Well, circumstances like that you're mentioning in those three recent stories that you just brought up, I mean, that's definitely sounding like a guardian angel effect to me. That's something is telling them, they're warning them to do something, and they act on the warning, and then they can see where their life has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Other times where it's like a climber, a mountain climber who's hurt, is that really a presence? Or is that like in your subconscious, you have this defense mechanism, which you just never call upon during your normal day, but under times of serious duress and stress, that natural instinct kicks in and you perceive it as a voice.
But it doesn't do it for everybody.
No, it doesn't.
That's what's weird. If it was an instinct like that, you would figure it would settle with most. It would be a fight or flight. This person would dig deep and do it. But that's not what it is. And what's even crazier is there's people that have had this happen to them in these survival situations that figure out how to do things that they don't even know how they do.
Exactly.
That they have, it's like all of a sudden they figured this stuff out that they're like, I wasn't trained in this. I've never been trained in this, but that's just what this person was telling me to do, so I did it.
I was just following orders.
Exactly.
And it worked out in my favor.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the guy, DeFrancisco. I mean, he's talking about, he was one of only a few people that made it out of that tower.
Mm-hmm.
The voice was telling him what to do, and he was just going by it.
Just going with it.
You know, and then there's other cases. Now, let me get this. I need to bring this up, because they also say that people that have been terrible mourning, the passing of a sibling or the passing of a spouse or a loved mm-hmm. one, that people sense their presence. Sometimes these, you know, a widow will sense the presence of their spouse in the bed with them at night
mm-hmm.
or in his favorite chair, say like your favorite chair if you were to go, or if your grandparents, people sense the presence of a loved one. Now that I don't necessarily know if that's the third man effect, because that's just the sense of somebody passing.
True.
But they do say it happens more often in people who are having more trouble with the mourning. And they say that when someone dies, for you to sense the presence of a loved one gone is as much as 40% of people experience that.
Well,
that's quite common.
I talked about it when we actually interviewed Jim Harold. And then Jim had me come on his show and tell the story.
But
you
know what I mean?
And it helped my grandpa. I mean, it helped him completely change the person that he was from when he lost my grandmother till after he had that experience.
Well, and most people say that, according to the stories, is that the sense of a presence. They don't necessarily see them. They're not seeing ghosts. They're just sensing that they're there. And it comforts them.
Like
you said, it just kind of made them feel good. Now, to me, that's totally different, though, than helping you through a situation.
Yes.
Where they're talking to you.
You're exactly right.
They're
yes.
leading you out of a predicament, or like warning you before something happens.
Yes.
It's very interesting. And, you know, another thing I'd like to bring up is when we're talking about isolation, extreme isolation seems to bring this on. Cold weather seems to bring this on. You think about people marooned in a shipwreck. Well, lots of times in the middle of the ocean, you know, you can be very cold and isolated. Imagine drifting on a raft. Or even, I think the famous Charles Lindbergh had a case where he said he was getting drowsy.
Well, and there was phantoms in the cabin of the plane.
Helping him out.
Kinda,
and,
yeah.
You know, they talk about Native Americans or Inuit or Aboriginal people. Well, they would have these spirit trips they would have. Well, I can't think of the exact word. Where you were becoming into a man, you would have to go out in the woods on your own, survive, and then often you would be sleep deprived because you didn't have anything. You'd be starving because you didn't have much food. And they would have these epiphanies. They would have these encounters with a spirit or a presence. And they would come back, and that seems to somehow transform them. This is very common. The same thing is like, you know, even like Moses
mm-hmm.
or other people in the Bible. They go out on their own, and that's when they have these.
Well, the Aborigines,
encounters.
I believe, call them walkabouts. Isn't that what they talk about when they do it?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Some kind of spiritual trip
yeah.
that the people go on. This is customary in North America as well as Australia or even Africa. I mean, it's very accustomed. They have every custom has its own mm-hmm. traditions, but you know what I'm talking about. So is that what it is? If you really deprive yourself and put yourself in extreme isolation, does it create this presence? I guess there's no way to know.
No.
My thing is, I want to know, is it just your mind that's creating this? Or are people actually experiencing it?
I could believe in...
I'm sure it's some of both.
Well, I could believe in total isolation that it would be your mind creating something.
Right.
I could believe that.
I'm with you, yeah.
I cannot believe that when you're in a stressful life and death situation, that your mind is all of a sudden creating that. Because we know people that panic in adult league softball games when the game is tied. You know what I mean? So when you think about a life and death situation, I've seen people shut down. I mean, I've watched people in jiu-jitsu and wrestling and things, just when it gets tough and it's a one-on-one sport, people just stop. Just shut down.
Yeah, that's why practice is important.
Exactly.
In whatever extreme field you're doing, practice is important.
But you're not practicing survival. And that's just, but you, when you're learning these things, man, I don't know. It feels like something's coming. It feels like something's plugging you into maybe a, a string of consciousness that you normally don't get. I mean, I don't know what it is, but it does feel like something's going on.
Well, some of my favorite stories are the ones where multiple people, like Shackleton and the guys that escaped the Stoker from the prison, multiple people in the party, with independently, without saying anything to each other, all had the presence of another person with them.
All felt it.
They all felt it. And they're like, yeah, when we would stop to take a break, it would stop. And then when we would pick up pace again, it would begin and fall right in order and pick up pace with us. It's like always there, right there. And I wonder if that's what the story of the guardian angel is. I mean, is that just old school third man factor stories? Is that what's brought that about?
Maybe so. Maybe that's really what, maybe that was just the only way to explain it.
I mean, the reason I bring that up is because this has been experienced by not just religious people. From all people, there's been cases of people experiencing this. And there's been even, you know, for super religious people, there's been people that have claimed that they knew it was Jesus that actually helped them.
Mm-hmm.
So you get everything. It's very interesting. John Geiger, the book is The Third Man Factor. There's another book he's written called The Angel Effect. And it's a bunch of stories about guardian angels and stuff. Very interesting. Very interesting. Cam, what else is going on, man?
Not much. Just hope everybody's going to have a nice, safe, happy Labor Day.
That's right. Yeah, it's Labor Day here in the United States today.
I hope everybody's, if you're not off work, I wished you were. Wish everybody had some time off to relax a little bit. And that's about it, man. I've been real busy at work, and they've just been running me like wild, so I'm ready for the cooler weather.
Yeah, I think on Thursday we're going to do a continuation with some more of these third man and angel facts.
We've got some more good ones.
Stories.
I think we're going to bring
up on the show. I think that's pretty cool. Don't forget, if you want to hear that, you need to sign up for Expanded Perspectives Elite. Just go to the website, expandedperspectives.com, click on the top right tab, and follow the instructions. Please follow the instructions when you sign up. You have to wait sometimes for that page to refresh. I know it takes a little longer. It depends on really on what type of device you're signing up on, whether it's a phone, a tablet, a desktop, what kind of service provider you have, where you are when you're signing up. So, I mean, there's a whole gambit of things that can determine whether you successfully install that. But after that, it's pretty simple. If you have any stories of your own, if you have any own guardian angel stories or third man effects, if any of you
want, I would love to hear them.
You can email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. You know the deal. You can write us a review on iTunes. That really helps us out. And we're just getting ready. We only got a couple more weeks before the Paradigm Symposium.
Yep.
I can't wait.
We'll be up there.
If you haven't bought your tickets yet, make sure to get those. Paradigm Symposium. And I guess everybody have a good one. Don't work too hard. And we'll speak to you elite members on Thursday. For everybody else, stay out of trouble. Keep your nose to the grindstone. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale. This is Expanded Perspectives.
Peace.
Get a good feeling, yeah.